So let's get started with where we're going. Okay. We're talking about a balanced approach. You know, that old song, love and marriage, you can't have one without the other. Well, we could have a whole day session on that today. But it still is true for iron and EPO. To have both of them work the way they're supposed to, you have to have a balance. And that's going to be more and more important as the new guidelines come out. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. The first thing is understanding the importance of each one and looking at a little physiology, because I think the first thing we need every morning is a nice dose of physiology. So those of you that have heard me before will get a refresher course in physiology, and the ones that haven't, I hope it will make it plain to you, give you some insight on what's going on, because I think if we understand the physiology, then we're going to be able to make better decisions when we're looking at our protocols and looking at our patients. We're going to review the KDOQI guidelines, which is going to be a little tricky because the new ones are in press. So I can't tell you exactly what they're going to look like, but I can tell you what we know, and the information that I have will be coming from one presentation that I heard from Trish McCarley, who represented all nursing in that endeavor, because she was the only nurse that was on that committee. And I really appreciate her stepping up and taking that role, because we need nursing representation everywhere. And from transcripts from Dr. Fishbane and Dr. Foley. So the guidelines are in press, so they could still change, but I will give you what I know of them, and then we'll have to wait and see. We're going to discuss some of the limitations of iron and what we're looking at, so that you understand when you're looking at your protocols what that number means, because that's one of the biggest things that we need to understand, along with what are some of the influences that our patients have that change those protocols. Are those true measures or not true measures? And then some of the things that you can do as you're dealing with that. So starting out with erythropoiesis, and we can't use pointers because I'm not very good like this, or I'd be working at the airport. If you look across the top, you see EPO and iron. And that's where those things fit in. We're going to talk about it as we go. But those are the two big barriers, is having the balance that we're going to talk about today in EPO and in iron. But imagine yourself, you are a stem cell, okay? And you're coming out of, you know, you're in the bone marrow and you want to grow up and be a red blood cell. It's going to take you 25 days to get out in circulation when you look around, look down at the horizontal bar at the bottom. You come out as a reticulocyte, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But look down there at the timing. When it's, I don't even care if you remember what these stand for, but that's a blast-forming unit. About that time, that's when the EPO receptors actually come around the cell and they protect the cell. And they're telling, you know, they're like Bob Barker's show, you know, come on down. They want the EPO to come on down and be incorporated into the cell so the cell can mature. Then around 19, 20 days, it changes and there's more transferrin receptors around the cell, and it's doing the same thing to the iron, and it's saying, come on down, so that it can incorporate iron into the cell. The interesting thing is that if you don't have iron there then, you can't put it in later. So it's important that it's there at that time. And we have to think that every day is a day 19-20 to a cell or a number of cells in the body. And that's why it's so important to have maintenance iron. And it's interesting because, as I understand it, the new KDOQI guidelines are going to be silent on repletion. But maintenance, it's just iron therapy, and it doesn't give you all the repletion things that we had in the last guidelines. So day 21, the cell comes out and says, boy, I'm a reticulocyte. But it takes another 4 days for it to be a red blood cell. So let's stop and think about what we're doing in our units. I don't know how often y'all get hemoglobins, but we get them at least twice a month, and if someone's out of range, we get them weekly. And so I tell the anemia managers in our unit to just keep a ruler on their desk, and if they have changed that dose within the last month and they want to change it again, just to hit themselves over the knuckles with that ruler and stop, Okay. Now you may have to pad the ruler for if the physician comes by and wants to change the... And I can't tell you that I never change the dose because I'm not consistent to never or always do almost anything. If I have a good reason, I might. But we get so busy that it's important that you look back and see when it was last changed, because you can see from this that if you've made a change within the last 2 weeks, for instance, you haven't seen the result of your change. So if you change it again now, you're kind of just like that dog chasing its tail. You're not going to know what's going on. So you, the other levels are just to trim the daily. And if something really bad happens, to adjust to it. But most of the time, it's just trending data and to make sure things are going on, except when you have people on hold, okay? As soon as you start seeing patients start trending down, you don't wait until they get into the, you know, if you wait until they get between 11 and it will be 13, you may be too late. So as I start seeing them trend down, I'll restart the EPO and then kind of watch. So that's a little bit about where they fit in and how important they are. Let's take a look at the normal iron cycle. Iron's pretty well balanced in the body. You lose 1 to 2 milligrams a day in the, you absorb 1 to 2 milligrams in the gut, and you lose 1 to 2 milligrams in the gut. And then you have transferrin. I look at transferrin as kind of like it's like the iron taxi. It actually is a protein. And what it does is it picks up 2 iron molecules and takes it wherever it wants to go, and it can make about 10 trips a day. So it's taking the iron to storage to wherever the need is. And then we have about a third of the iron or a fourth of the iron in storage in the liver and some other tissues. We have about two-thirds or three-fourths of it that's actively in red blood cells or in the RE system. And then we have a very small amount in the muscle for myoglobin and other enzymes. But go back and look at transferrin, because I didn't make a point that I wanted to. Look how much iron is in transferrin. Precious little, 3 to 4 milligrams, okay? So let's look at iron in our hemodialysis patients. They absorb less iron. Why? Malnutrition for one thing. And then if we're trying to get their secondary hyperparathyroidism treated, we give them a lot of binders. And so iron binds with some of the drugs that we give them. So they get less in, same amount out. Look at the transferrin. In this cartoon, you can see there's about half of it. Why is that? Well, first of all, you know, we always kind of know that ferritin is an acute phase reactant. But transferrin is also an acute phase reactant. Ferritin goes up, transferrin and albumin both go down. And so there's usually most of our patients have less transferrin than the normal person. We have decreased iron stores in our patients. If you tested a patient that's on dialysis and a patient that's not on dialysis, and you looked at what their serum ferritin is, for any serum ferritin, the dialysis patient will probably actually have less iron that's in storage, and I'm going to show you a little research on that in just a little bit. And then, what are we doing to that bone marrow? Okay, we are just flogging the heck out of it with a lot of EPO because we need to get those outcomes better. Okay, so we have these big, big doses of EPO that we're giving patients that are super physiological. At the same time, we're losing iron. Somewhere, I'm going to show you, it's an older slide, but you can lose a gram and a half to 2.5, that neighborhood, grams of iron a year just in our hemodialysis processes by bleeding at the end of dialysis, the blood that's left in the dialyzer, et cetera. And then we have the same issues with the muscle before. Okay, so the markers of iron, we look at them. We have serum ferritin, which I hope you understand now is an indirect measure, because the ferritin that's actually in the bloodstream does not reflect the amount of iron that we actually have in storage. We have a transferrin, but we actually don't measure transferrin, do we? We measure transferrin saturation. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. And then we have hemoglobin, which is the only one that we actually truly measure. So the iron indices that we look at are indirect measures. Lots of things affect them. And that's one of the reasons there's so much controversy on what is the right dose? What are the right indices to look at? So I didn't know this till I started talking for Watson a long, seems like eons ago, but it was just a little over a year. But that TIBC, total iron binding capacity, is actually a surrogate marker for transferrin. And when we look at transferrin saturation, you can see that the equation here, that your TIBC is the denominator. And what we found is that if that TIBC is low, which is under 200, then your transferrin saturation may be falsely high. So when I'm trending iron and looking at the sheets that the anemia manager brings me, then one of the things I always look at is, what is that TIBC? And if it's below 200, then I think, well, my TSAT may not be reliable. If it's above 200, I take the TSAT at face value. And you can see from the cartoon down there that the one that has low has a low TIBC has less iron on it than the one that has a TIBC above 200. So when to simplify things, and there are a lot of things, but they are not simple. Obviously, if the doctors are fussing and going on and arguing about it, there's always more to the story. But we look at it simplistically as transferrin being the circulating iron transport protein. Okay, remember a protein. We're going to talk about malnutrition. And it has the two binding sites. But that iron is immediately available. So when you give, especially the new irons that have a lot of, have very good bioavailability, even in small doses if your ferritins are high, then that iron is immediately available for the body to use. It's generally elevated because you need more taxis if you have iron deficiency. But in the presence, especially of malnutrition, inflammation, and chronic disease, it's low. Well, most of our patients have malnutrition, inflammation, and chronic disease. So we really need to be looking at it patient by patient. And that's my take-home message for all day. In case you miss it, I'll tell you again. Ferritin. In the perfect world, which our patients don't live in, when a serum ferritin, when an iron goes into storage, a serum ferritin comes out. So the iron goes in, and tissue ferritin is very, very rich in iron. And into circulation comes a serum ferritin. But also, for a lot of reasons, anytime there's infection, inflammation, more serum ferritin comes in. If patients have poor clearances of serum ferritin, or if they have liver disease, you're going to have even higher serum ferritins. So when you're looking at ferritins and adjusting what's going on, you really have to look and see, what is the history? Is there something hidden I'm missing? Is this iron that I've, you know, have I missed tweaking a dose of iron? Or is this, is there more to the story? And frequently there's more to the story. This is data from the 2004 clinical performance measures product and project, and you can see on the vertical axis that's your EPO dose per units per kilogram per week, and the horizontal axis is your hemoglobin. And you kind of think, oh, the lower hemoglobins, it makes sense that they're on a lot more iron. But look, you have some higher hemoglobins that also have a lot of better using a lot of EPO, excuse me. And I would suggest to you that when you're using really big doses of EPO, it may be that what you're dealing with is functional iron deficiency. I know when I have a patient who's really iron deficient and anemic, I may start them on both, you know, even though those old guidelines said replete their iron and then start the EPO, I don't think many of us do that. But if they're iron deficient, I generally start them on the iron and on a lower dose of EPO because we need that balance. And I bet you that the people that are on the plus 14 side got a nice sized dose of EPO along with their iron and they kind of overshot. And again, it's a balance. So those of you that are sitting in the audience, I didn't ask before, but if I ask for a raise of hands on how many are anemia managers, how many would raise your hands? Go ahead and do it and keep them up. Okay, and how many of y'all work with anemia managers? Keep your hands up. How many of y'all manage people that are anemia managers? How many of y'all work in CKD clinics that should have an anemia manager? So if all of the hands are up, or just about all of them, the people that didn't raise your hand need to be nice to all of these people that raised their hands because they have a tough job. It takes, you know, like I'm from Arkansas, so, you know, Hillary Clinton's from there, and you know how she said it takes a village to raise a child? I think it takes a major city to take care of a dialysis patient. And so together we need to look, and if your NEMI manager is not familiar with your caseload of patients, you know, those patients are your responsibility. You need to be telling her or him what they need to know from the things that we're going to be talking about today, because it's going to be very important to have teams and go back to the real CQI process that we talked about back in the 90s. And Debbie's going to give you some good examples of that and what they've done in their unit in a little bit. Well, this is an older slide, but I put it here to remind myself. You know, I told you that with newer products, we may be losing a gram and a half. Some people say that all the way up, we're still probably losing 2.5, that neighborhood, grams of iron a year. Well, if you look at that and say, patients are losing that much, how are you giving that back to them? And so this is the data, again, from 2004. And look at those patients. We had a third of the patients that were getting less than 100 milligrams of iron a month. If you're looking at 2.5 grams, that neighborhood, you're looking at 250, 270 milligrams a month, okay? So you've got a good over 50% of your patients that are getting less than 200 milligrams a month. If that's the case, you need to think, why? This patient, by my protocol or whatever you're going by, is not on that much iron. Should they be? Okay, are we missing the boat to balance the iron and the EPO? And then those higher doses are probably patients that replete. And I'll tell you that even though I don't replete, I do it because I'm getting old, I'm just not smart enough to remember to start something after 8 or 10 doses. And if you're looking at iron on a monthly basis, then what I like to do is I just generally start out at 125 milligrams twice a week. In a month, I've given the dose that usually is a repletion dose, and it's time to look and see where they're at. Because some people, you know, most of the time you have to tweak it down at that point, but some people need a little bit more. So you have to come into a different mindset on what you're doing and how you're doing it. So KDOQI guidelines, here's the skinny as I understand it. Serum ferritin, the old guidelines are 100 to 800. The newer guidelines are gonna bump that 100 up to 200. And they're not really gonna give you a definite target for when to stop. They're gonna say to look at patients at 500. Now we look at patients all the time. We really need to assess the patient and see where they are and what we need to be doing. The same thing with your TSAT, which is your circulating iron. It's going to start at 20 and not give you an upper limit. We're going to talk more about that. And then instead of having a hemoglobin target, the new verbiage is you're going to have a hemoglobin range that's going to be between 11 and 13. And I don't really have time to talk about all the reimbursement stuff that's coming along with that, but that actually is coming. Some of the reimbursement changes are happening this month. The guidelines look like they're in press, but they may be postponed just a little bit. I thought they were coming out quickly, but it may take another couple of months. I love this slide. This data is freely available to us, and we have gotten a little better in some of our areas. But let's talk about from a overall patient standpoint, where are our problem areas so that we can know in your units and you can think about right now, where are my problem areas and who are these patients that I'm dealing with? If you look across, the first one that's really a dip is catheter patients, okay? So I could tell you, number one, those catheter patients are my new patients, my sicker patients, my malnourished patients. But those patients usually fall below target. What can I do to bring them up? Are they that way because their ferritins are high and we're frequently holding? Should I go to whoever your prescriber is if you're fortunate enough to have an APN? Because of all of the nephrology nurses, I think we APNs really can be such an asset to your unit because most of us are just freely available to you. Look at the KT over Vs. The patients that have low KT over Vs are the next ones that don't meet targets as well, 70%. Are those your catheter patients? are those your patients that chronically cut their treatment short? What's going on with there? What can you do to increase adequacy? Because we know that if you increase adequacy, your outcomes will be better. Look at serum albumin, 62% when the serum albumin are low. Remember that those are proteins that we're looking at that our transferrin saturation is based on. So if they're malnourished, those indices that you're looking at are not true, and perhaps they may need a deeper assessment than what we're giving. And then obviously those that have been on a short amount of time, and that just, you can, if you actually collect that data and show your doctor those outcomes, maybe you can entice them to start an anemia management clinic in their offices. So what are the things that put our patients at risk for anemia? Obviously blood loss, the balance of that EPO and iron that we're going to talk more about, and infection and inflammation. And that's one of the big things, like, why don't we just give everybody gobs of iron? Well, the big things that you hear, especially in the chronic kidney disease in your earlier stages of CKD, is oxidation injury. And I will tell you that I come from the University of Arkansas, and many of my collaborative physicians and the chief of nephrology, we do a lot of bench research on oxidation injury. So what we would tell you, and what some of my folks would say, is how much iron do you need? You need the least amount of iron to get the job done. But I hope that you'll realize by the time we get through that we are not getting the job done with the amount of iron we're frequently given. And it takes us, and we have the assessment skills to do it. We can argue we don't have the time, but if we get everybody involved, from the reuse tech and the patient care tech, feeding us information, it will make the job of the anemia manager and the job of the prescribers in the unit so much easier. And I'm going to focus a little bit and show you some of the research, because this is an evidence-based meeting, on malnutrition, adequacy, and bone disease. So let's start with, did I go up two slides? Nope, sorry, okay. First one we're going to talk about is bone disease. This is a study that was done by Rayo in 1993, but I like the way that he did it. He took patients of his that had been on dialysis for over a year, and they'd been on EPO over a year, and looked, they had gotten in their target range in a reasonable amount of time, they had maintained with a reasonable stable dose of EPO, no symptoms of hyperparathyroid disease or aluminum-related bone disease. Aluminums were fine, and there was no known cause for any EPO resistance. And then he separated them. He put the poor response group for those that had big doses of EPO, okay, above 100 units per kilogram per week, and three times a week, and then the good response group was less than that. And let's look at his results. My slide's not there. I thought that one was there first, so my slides may be slightly out of order. I'll tell you what the results were in a second, because they'll come up. But there was a huge difference in how much EPO it took. These were stable hematocrits, but just by controlling their bone disease, they were able to use lower doses of EPO. And we see that all the time, because if you get a patient that's had a parathyroidectomy, the one thing that always amazed me is that after that parathyroidectomy, you know, they had been on these huge, huge doses of EPO, and they come back to reasonable doses of EPO and you can get them into target. So this is the nutritional data here, and this is by Calandarzotti. And these are TIBCs. Again, this is protein. And you can see they did subjective global assessments. And the TIBC is on the vertical axis, and you can see that I said TIBCs below 200 may not be reliable. And when you get over to the severely malnourished, and the doctor just didn't do these. The doctor did one, but he was validated by a dietitian. I'm sure he thought he was validating the dietitian. I'm not sure which way that worked, but they were validated SGAs. And so you can see from this that truly, the more malnourished your patient is, the lower the TIBC, which would be the lower amount of transferrin. And on the reverse side, this data has been updated, and it's 2004 data. with serum ferritins, look at the serum ferritins in the malnourished patients. So if you go over to the severe, the range there was from 800 all the way up into the low thousands. So that is a significantly high ferritin that you would go, maybe I shouldn't be giving iron to this patient, when in fact this patient is severely malnourished, and if they don't have an active infection, probably you do need to give them low-dose iron and see if it works. If it doesn't work, you should stop. Okay, this is the slide that should have followed the bone slide. And you can see that that held true. Group A, which was the group that had the big doses of EPO, took them 185. They were the patients that had the low KT over Vs, took 185 units of EPO to get the same response that people that had, good adequacy. So the patients that, this was a study by Movilli where they looked at what your adequacy was, what your KT over V was. So the ones that were poorly dialyzed or didn't meet your targets used, more than twice the amount of EPO per treatment than the group B, which was well dialyzed. So if you're looking at what's going on with your patients and how much EPO you're using, this would be another way to look at, if I treated these patients with iron, do they need it or do they not? Also, if I can improve their adequacy, so looking at access and other things would improve your outcomes. I apologize for the slide being out of order. This is the poor versus the good, and you can see that the poor used 174 units per kilogram three times a week compared to the good group that used 56. So that is a huge difference. Look at those PTHs. A big difference in whether they were out of target or in target. And then when they actually did bone marrow biopsies, the ones that were in the poor group that used all the EPO had problems with their bone marrow. And that's just another reason to listen to all of the secondary hyperparathyroidism talks and try to start treatments early and get these patients where their bone marrow doesn't suffer this damage.